I just spilled water on my crotch.
Please tell me you're recording. Yes. That's great to start off with. In tech we trust.
It's the people in charge we're not sure about.
Hello and welcome to episode, 54. Of the In Tech We Trust podcast, and we are live from Tech Unplugged in Amsterdam. Can I get a little drum roll on the table, please, guys? I don't know how that'll come through. Massive shout out, okay, to one of our special guests. We've actually got four guests on the show today. First and foremost, though, Enrico Signoretti. Welcome to the show, Enrico. We had you on a couple of...
Woo! Thank you. Thank you for having me.
The event's going really well so far. We're really pleased and stoked to be recording live from the event. How are you feeling about the event? You didn't sleep much last night?
No, not that much, but really, the event is good so far. I talked to a lot of people. They are happy about the presentation, about the interactions. I'm happy.
Cool. Okay, we have another interesting guest. I don't know if the microphone can pick up the deep and dulcet tone. There you go. Anybody know who that is? Mr. Hans Delinier.
Hello there.
Now, I'm hoping you're going to be quiet, Hans, because you don't know anything about what's going on in the industry anymore.
No.
You're so out of touch.
So is Hans actually a guest, or is he just... host emeritus?
Well, I wanted Hans to host it and do the intro, actually, but he was quite strict on the fact that I had to do the intro. Anyway, it is a pleasure to have you on, Hans.
Thank you. I'm just here to be the roadie with the setup is still alive. I just don't use it anymore.
So you're like 3 months or so into your new gig now. Is that good for you?
Yeah, all career firsts every other week. It's a blast. It took me a while to find something new, but it's definitely worth waiting for.
Good. Okay, we're glad for you. And we just heard the tones of Howard Marks from Greybeards on Storage. How are you, Howard?
I'm doing great. Woo! I'm very happy to be here at Tech Unplugged. Amsterdam's one of my favorite cities. And this is the first time I've been to Amsterdam and not visited a coffee shop. So, different experience this time.
What do you mean?
Coffee shops in Amsterdam only secondarily sell coffee.
I just wondered if coffee shops was like a secret code word for something else in Amsterdam, but I don't know.
I was thinking it was a safe word.
Coffee shop in Dutch is the place with the picture of Bob Marley in the window and the marijuana and hashish on the menu. Usually they sell coffee, but not necessarily.
Ah, okay, fair enough. And our final guest for the week, Chris Meller from The Register. Welcome, Chris.
Hello, everybody. Thank you.
Yeah. So looking forward to this, all right? We've got three items on the agenda, and I do think they were all written by you, potentially, Chris. The first one that we've got, right, from a news perspective, actually, this one probably wasn't written by you, but there was, I think either Sunday or Monday, there was a mega outage at Amazon Web Services, okay? The DynamoDB system was doing slow responses, and it kicked people in the nuts like Netflix and Airbnb and a bunch of big companies, right, who are all relying on Amazon Web Services. So the question that I want to throw out to everybody, right, is I love Amazon Web. Well, I love the cloud in general, right? But are we at an increased risk when we start deploying on platforms like this where we have a little bit less control over the infrastructure versus when we deploy on-prem?
Amazon running AWS is about 30 to 50% more competent than the average corporate IT department
running
their infrastructure. And so, people have failures of their database engine in the corporate world all the time, and you just don't hear about it. Right? That every time Amazon fails, it will make the press because Netflix is going to go down and people aren't going to be able to watch Marvel Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. And if I can't watch Marvel Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., then I can't afford the G.I. Joe with the Kung Fu grip, and kids are going to be upset with me on Christmas. So it's not that they fail more often. We're not increasing our risk. We're just still taking that risk.
Don't you think the risk becomes more visible, though? Because if you're running a storage for a corporate department, and you tell people, I'm sorry, we're going to be 1.5 days without any ability for you to access your storage at all, you're going to lose your job. So this Amazon outage just points to the increased risk of sticking storage in the cloud. You could lose access to your data for 36 hours. It's not funny.
No, it's not funny at all. But, if your VMAX crashed and your database was down for a day and a half, you'd lose your job. the odds that if AWS went down and your users couldn't access their applications for a day and a half, that you'll lose your job is actually less because you get to blame Amazon. And some percentage of the time, senior management is going to go, yeah, it's not your fault. You picked Amazon. Amazon was safe. It's kind of the, you know, nobody gets fired for buying IBM. That if IBM fails, it's IBM's fault. If the startup fails, it's the guy who picked the startup's fault.
Can I just want to interject there. So surely, though, as much as I like Amazon Web Services and Azure and stuff like that, we're not at the point, are we, of saying that deploying to Amazon Web Services is the equivalent of buying IBM, because that was, we're not.
No,
there,
no. Not in terms of how safe it is, but in terms of how much you, as the guy who chose it, will get blamed for their failure.
Oh, okay, I'm with you. I see that. Fair play.
And I also think that there is a particular problem with a specific data center, because the fault was in the Virginia data center.
It's always there, right?
It's always there.
US East,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Well, so probably they have a specific problem there. And you as a customer probably need to spread your application.
You definitely need to spread your application out. And the problem is US East is the nexus for a lot of what they do. And some things are only available in US East.
It's the birthplace of Amazon Web Services.
Right. And so if US East goes down, then it affects most of AWS. But you know, if you're Netflix or Airbnb, and then you got to develop a multi-billion-dollar company without having to raise billions of dollars to buy hardware, and so you take some risk to go along with that.
So every now and then, Chaos Kong comes along and takes you out.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Well, I actually have to disagree with you, Howard, on the and that's why
we're
here, right?
We don't have disagreements anymore.
Right?
We've been missing you.
Yeah.
We've been missing
you. So I totally disagree that the responsibility of you as an IT person or company is less because it's run by someone else who can make the mistake. The problem is that we sign SLAs with those companies. What is an SLA? An SLA is just they saying to you, this is what we'll do for you within a specific performance interval. If they fail, it is still your responsibility because it is your information, not the data as such, but you as a company are responsible for their failure as well. It's not because you signed an SLA that you gave away your responsibility for the information.
Oh, I agree.
So if I sign a contract with to put my data somewhere in the cloud, it is still my responsibility that if the cloud fails, that it is still available. And a lot of people think that an SLA for them is a certain form of safety. It is not. An SLA does not give you safety. The only thing an SLA does is a contract. And when something fails and they bridge that contract, you can sue them, but you don't don't have your data back.
It's worse than that. Cloud service SLAs are like the SLA Kodak used to give you when you mailed a roll of film in to be developed. And that is, if they lose your roll of film, they'll give you a new roll of film.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, so the SLA is protection for the cloud provider. The cloud provider has an SLA that says, if we miss this SLA, you get a free month. But that sets the maximum that you can be awarded is that free month. You could have sued them for the $100 million of business you lost, but the SLA says you only get a free month.
So you as a company are still,
responsible
for the information that you put in the cloud.
Yeah. All
so
I was talking about was the odds of getting fired.
Yeah.
I wasn't talking about actual responsibility.
That's the point where I'm coming to. If Amazon goes down and your application goes down, it is still your fault that you did not choose a second provider to keep your application running. So you still have the same risk of being fired because of that mistake.
Well, I went to management and asked for a second, and they said they didn't have the money.
You have the same problem with the other vendors. So none of them give you an SLA of some kind.
The
worst thing that can happen is that the system doesn't work and you can get the money back for the hardware.
The chance of Amazon and Azure going down at the same time is astronomically small.
Yeah, the problem is that AWS and Azure are such different architectures that you can't actually host an application on both of them. It's like hosting a failover from Windows to Linux. It is theoretically possible, but it's a lot more work. you know, if you really want to get into the...
Got to use Docker.
Yeah.
But if you really want to get into the, I'm going to run my application on multiple cloud providers, you have to go to really IaaS, not PaaS. And AWS and Azure are much more platform than they are infrastructure.
So I just want to say one thing. I think I was in the air coming over from the U.S. when this outage happened. I was in an old 747, which, you know, doesn't have a lot of great internet access. The plane did not crash. It didn't swerve around. We landed. When I got here, the trains were running. You know, and it makes you kind of think, right? What if we start doing, you know, operation stuff in the cloud?
Yeah.
You know, you're not gonna have a fail safe in an airplane fail because Amazon goes down. But, you know, you think about these infrastructure things, right? Train systems. But if train systems at some point become dependent on the cloud?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because it saves a lot of money. Uh-huh. Oh, what a screw-up that would be.
You know what? It's probably not 5 years away, but I can see a future potentially where a lot more of that stuff is in the cloud. Yeah. I want two things. So I think maybe, Mark, what you said there about got to use Docker or containers was potentially very astute because it does, at some levels, right, abstract that underlying platform. But coming back to Howard's, you don't get fired for buying Amazon... Like, just off the cuff.
Might not get
fired. No, I know. Yeah, I'm not quoting you there. But I think the thing is, Amazon are the IBM of the cloud. You know, you're more likely to get fired if you recommended Hans Delinier's home cloud solution versus Amazon Web Services, right? Maybe that was the point that you were getting to. All right, so I want to move the conversation along a little bit. So there's been a little bit of infighting going on in the hyper-converged world. Like, that happens all the time, right? Yeah. Those guys are terrible, right? So we've got...
Now that Chuck's moved to Oracle, it's coming.
Yeah, yeah. So SimpliVity versus SpringPath, okay. Chris, this is one of your pieces, right? Do you want to give us just a quick rundown?
Yeah. SimpliVity have about 37 patents for their technology, both hardware and software. One of their patents is called the 799 patent, and it refers to how a file system talks to object storage. SimpliVity's alleging that SpringPath is infringing its IP in that patent and using it unlawfully. So it wants SpringPath please to cease and desist, pay royalties for the past infringements, and stop doing it in future. SpringPath hasn't issued a statement, as far as I know, about whether it thinks this suit has any merit or not.
So the thing is, right, throughout IT, and it probably extends well beyond there, right, what is the value of a patent? Because we see these things go on in court for years and years and years, right? It doesn't ever tend to stop somebody developing product and pushing to customers. I mean, this thing, I could be wrong, right, but I would expect it to be locked up in court for a very long time while both companies carry on. There'll be a fine paid in the end by one company. But, just speaking generally here. Right? I'm not saying they are infringing, but when that happens, you know, Oracle...
I'm sorry. Western Digital hired a guy from Seagate who came to Western Digital with giant magneto-resistive head knowledge of what Seagate was doing and passed it on. He shouldn't have done. Western Digital infringed the Seagate patent, used its trade secrets, ended up paying more than $500 million to Seagate. It took years, but that was a lawsuit that Seagate found very worthwhile doing.
Yeah, but that was an intentional infringement. The difference between patent and copyright law is you have to copy to violate copyright law. You can independently invent the same thing and violate the guy's patent because he patented it first.
Yes.
And so you can get $500 million for stealing an employee who took trade secrets with you that there was a patent attached to. That's a very different thing from two little companies, well, a medium size and a little company, and a software patent. And, you know, I am old enough that I remember when software wasn't patentable, and I think we should go back to that.
I wonder that
software patents are a bad idea that were invented by courts, not by legislators. You know, Dan Bricklin made plenty of money from VisiCalc. He never had a patent on it because software wasn't patentable then. There was no shortage of software development when software wasn't patentable. And patents run for 20-some-odd years. An idea in the software world is maybe in that kind of value you should have protection for it for 5 years.
And hardware patents?
Hardware patents are completely different.
Because
it's the expression of the idea, not an idea. Because it's how things work. Because if you're talking about software patents for a method to do something, you're patenting mathematics. You're patenting basic algorithms. guys have tried to patent double entry bookkeeping and gotten the patent issued. And then 10 years later, when there was a lawsuit, the patent was ruled invalid. It doesn't, you know, like extending copyrights to run 120 years so Mickey Mouse never comes out of copyright.
I'm going to give up at this point, Howard, because then I'd say on firmware and gradually try and link the software and hardware worlds together.
Oh, that's where you're going. That's where you're going with that.
Yeah, but that's the same slippery fish as your car now has 27 microprocessors in it, all of which have software, and General Motors.
Oh,
under
we've got
the
software-defined emissions testing.
Right, and so there's two parts of that. First of all, so General Motors can say that you didn't pay the support on your car, so you don't get the software upgrade, or they disable the software, or you can't modify your car because DCMA says you can't modify the software. And then there's the Volkswagen bit, which I find really interesting.
But let's not go there. Let's not go there right now. Yeah. We got more to cover. I think the important thing in this deal right here is that Simplivity had so much money they didn't know what to do with it, and so they wanted to sue someone flat out. Well, what are we going to do with all these millions of dollars? I don't know. Let's sue SpringPath.
There's one point in that. There's different reasons to sue someone over patents. One of the reasons that we do see is bigger vendors suing the very small ones that could potentially have risk to stall them. Because if you only have 15, 20 people in your company, 30 people, someone is taking the time to prepare the answers, to talk to lawyers. You are stalling the company at some way. There is impact, specifically for the very small companies.
Are you suggesting then that Simplivity may be seeing scale here as a potential threat?
I would agree with that, yes. That it is a form of stalling them.
It's like EMC suing Pure Storage in a way, then.
Exactly.
You're a big threat. We want
the same thing. Yeah. The same way as Symantec sued Veeam a couple of years ago, they've won it now, 4 or 5 years later. But at that time, I remember I was working for Avar. We were at the point of becoming a partner of Veeam, and we stalled that partnership just because of that. We were afraid that Veeam could go out of business because of the results of the lawsuit. So that was a dangerous part.
You said something. I got confused earlier when you were talking about this. I thought you said SpringPath.
Yes, you're right. I said scale there, didn't I?
Scale.
It is SpringPath.
Okay.
Spring path.
Okay.
Yeah, that was my bad a second
okay.
ago. Yeah. So what we're saying is that Simplivity here have given a ringing endorsement to SpringPath potentially.
It could be. I mean, it could be one of the reasons.
Okay, so the next piece that we've got up then is apparently, and I never know what to think about Nexenta as a company and as their products go, right? But Chris, you've got another piece out there that's saying one particular company found that Nexenta outperformed the likes of vSAN and Nutanix and company, yeah?
Yes.
It's potentially quite controversial here, so
yeah,
go on.
The release said that Nexenta software provided big benefits to this backup company in Canada, this managed services supplier in Canada. And one of the things was it said it could now have 27,000 IOPS from its storage. Well, actually, looking at a Nexenta case study on the same company, that company used a Zeus RAM disk. Mm. In other words, Steck's old caching software, now owned by HGST, and they're caching their storage accesses into RAM SSD. Well, of course they're getting a great deal of storage IOPS improvement. That's partly why.
That points out one of the big differences between software-defined storage and software-delivered storage, and that's NVRAM. So that Steck is DRAM and an ultracapacitor. You know, it's basically a SATA or SAS NVDIMM. And so that way Nexenta can put NVRAM in industry standard hardware.
It's great stuff, Howard. I mean,
oh no, it's great, but that's really in terms of performance, a lot of the difference between the storage you buy as software and it put on a server yourself and the box that comes with the software installed is that box also has an NVDIMM in it someplace.
Yeah, these guys can do this because they've got their Nexenta storage, which is independent of the disk storage underneath. They've got the hardware freedom. They can stick a Zeus RAM in the server running the Nexenta software and turbocharge the hell out of it.
Right.
And the benefits are absolutely great for them. But it's not just the Nexenta software going.
No, and it would be really interesting to see how big the test set was. Because, you know, as a guy who does benchmarks for a living, the biggest lie that vendors do when they run benchmarks.
Vendors lie, right?
When their lips move, yeah.
No.
But the biggest falsity that gets introduced into benchmarking is if you have a hybrid system that's got a performance tier and a capacity tier, you run the benchmark on a set of data smaller than the performance tier.
So it fits in the cache.
And if you're talking about that and it's a RAM cache, boy, is that going to be fast. But boy, is it going to be nothing like reality.
Yeah, but we are talking about ZFS here, so it's not just the cache because they are managing only the ZIL and, on the ZIL's RAM, I think.
The ZFS intention log.
Yeah.
It's a very small write cache.
Yeah.
And people forget that write caches are just shock absorbers. Mm-hmm.
I like that.
You know, a write cache is only useful as long as that write cache has some free space. Mm. As soon as the write cache becomes 100% full, then your performance falls down to the performance of the backing tier. And I've seen people do Pernix installations and have everything work fine for 4 or 5 days. Because it took 4 or 5 days for the cache to be completely full and then have performance fall off dramatically. And I've seen people on the Spiceworks forum recommend, well, the solution to that is just to get a bigger SSD. And it's, no, the solution to that isn't just to get a bigger SSD. The solution to that is to make the backing store fast enough eventually the write cache empties.
When you have the bigger SSD, then you have more to destage.
It just means it won't be 3 days, it'll be 3 months.
But isn't the answer to everything these days, it's just throw more hardware at it, like you're saying there, whether it's a bigger, faster back end or whether it's more caching at the front end. It's never, let's change the way that your application's designed or anything like that.
Well, you can get much bigger benefits by changing your applications, but it's much more expensive.
Different way, and risky.
The thing about having caching is that you need it because the network access to a disk array is so lousy. If the disk array was connected to your servers by something like an NVMe fabric, network latency goes away. Team, discuss.
Yeah, so we talked about this a few weeks ago, actually, the pros and cons of developing a proprietary high-speed fabric interconnect for storage systems that are housed away from your servers, but you don't want to go over fiber channel. You definitely don't want to go over an Ethernet network. We get that, you're going to get super fast performance and what have you, but doesn't that totally go against the grain of everything is commodity these days?
Well, we're talking about two or three different things. You know, directly to Chris's point, the latency across a modern 10 gig Ethernet is on the order of 300 nanoseconds. It's 300 microseconds. It's well under a millisecond. And the response time of a SAS SSD is approximately 5 times that. So if we're talking about the argument of, Nutanix, who says we have data locality and we try and keep the data on the local SSD, and we have vSAN, who says we don't care about that because the SSD latency is so much bigger than the network latency that it washes out, I lean towards that towards that argument.
So the background...
But that's for the average user in Tier 1. When we start talking about Tier 0, then the rack-scale NVMe, where that much faster SSD is actually faster than the 10-gig Ethernet, absolutely. But for 90% of the people who are running all-flash arrays today, they're looking for under 1 millisecond latency. They're not looking for under 300 nanosecond latency.
You don't need caching with DSSD, or rather you will not need caching with DSSD, or MangStore.
Right.
Or anybody else with a flash array using NVMe drives and an NVMe fabric link to serve.
I can't wait to see how fast Nexenta is with NVMe.
but you're also going to be limited to one rack, right? NVMe isn't, PCIe isn't and will never be a 100-meter interconnect. And so if I have an application, now, if we're talking about, the ultimate implementation of an Oracle rack kind of solution, DSSD, great idea. But, if we're not talking about I'm going to support 1,000 servers with shared storage from this one thing because you're not going to get that much connectivity.
Yeah, but the thing is, right, you're talking about developing new interconnects and what have you. That when we had the discussion on the show a few weeks ago, it was around DSSD and anybody else, like maybe a violin or somebody, that does But it's such a niche portion of the market at the moment. You just threw the number out there earlier, Howard, 90% of people don't need it. So why would you go down the route of developing a new fabric interconnect technology with all of the difficulties and complexities that comes with installing it, maintaining it, managing it for such a small...
Because that small number of people have very deep pockets.
Well, yeah, also,
we're talking about the Department of Defense and Wall Street.
But also, disk was once upon a time not COTS. People loaded their mainframe data from tape. Why did people start using disk when it was only applicable to a very small 1% of the market who could afford the millions of dollars needed to buy a RAMAC? Because the stuff was damn good.
And eventually it trickles down.
I think COTS, as we know it today, is going to have its day. New hardware is going to come along and throw it out of the water.
Commodity off the shelf, right?
Commodity off the shelf hardware. It's going to be rebalanced. I think software is doing a bit of rebalancing at the moment, but I think we're going to be in an era when hardware is going to be reinvented and go faster.
I think we all need to hope very hard that we analyze the hell out of everything. We'll just have analytics everywhere, because what else are we going to need all this power for?
Yeah, that's true.
You know, I got a haircut. I saved my hair. I analyzed all the strands of hair. Now I have it. I'm trying to figure out why it's falling out.
I'm trying to glue it back on.
Guys, it's been an absolute pleasure. I think another rattle on the table for Enrico and Tech Unplugged.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks for listening.